The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The FA Cup. Mark Hughes takes the Saints to Wembley in his first game. As elsewhere, the big guns all get through. Eriksen shines for Spurs. Pedro scores a header and Jose does lots of talking again. In the Premier League, it's so cold in Stoke that Charlie Adam gets sent off just so he can go inside. West Brom are all but down and Mo Salah really should be the player of the year. All that plus reaction to the England squad, the Champions League draw and the competitiveness of Neil Warnock. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Paul McInnes, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you very much.
You were in Stoke.
Yeah, I was. I was kind of like, oh, it's going to be okay. This mini beast from the east, I've looked at the BBC weather app. It's not going to snow that heavy. I got snowed on in the press box. The wind was so strong. There was so much snow. I got snowed on in the press box undercover. So you just couldn't actually work. And then dashing back to get back to London, I had to march through a blizzard for like 40 minutes.
Would you say
it was real?
The coldest you've been at a football match?
No, I think AFC Wimbledon's replay with Sutton last year was colder, and I don't know why, because the temperature was actually, but it just felt colder that night.
John Brubin, hello.
Hiya.
The coldest you've ever been at a football match?
A game at the World Cup in South Africa in 2010, of course it's their winter. I think it was Argentina, South Korea, and it was the coldest I've ever been, because it was the Soccer City Stadium right up at the top, altitude, temperature, wind chill, the lot.
And were you appropriately dressed?
No, because of course you set off for South Africa thinking the weather's going to be...
You're on safari, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Jacob Steinberg.
Hello.
The same question to you.
I remember a very cold afternoon at Upton Park quite a long time ago on Boxing Day. And 4 days later, they were playing... I think they stuffed Charlton at home, and then 4 days later, they were supposed to play Chelsea at home. And one of the executives said that hell would freeze over before the game was called off, and it was called off. And at this point, Chelsea hadn't won an away game all season, and the rearranged game, they won their first away game 3 months later. So,
would you go back to Upton Park, even if it was always that cold?
What, right now?
Yeah.
In its current guise as building site?
No, I'm saying is you could take West Ham from the London Stadium back to what was Upton Park, but it would always be...
That cold.
That cold.
Yeah.
Let's start with the FA Cup quarterfinals then. I've started with Leicester-Chelsea, Paul, because I thought this was the best of the games.
Yeah, probably some better goals at Spurs, but this was two teams actually going at each other and looking pretty equal, I think, for much of the game. Chelsea probably had the better of the, or were more dominant the first half. Leicester came back in the second. And it's small margins, I think, for Leicester. I think they're building something. I think in the middle of the park, Ndidi was dominant. Mahrez was as creative and assertive in the forward third as anybody that Chelsea had. And obviously, you know, Vardy got another goal. They had options from the bench too, so I think there's lots to take heart from. But in the end, yeah, they lost out to, you know, a mistake and a piece of probably the game's best piece of quality, that run and pass from Willian for the opening goal.
A word on Jamie Vardy. He scored 10 goals in 12 against the top six English sides in all competitions this season. No one would pick him ahead of Harry Kane for England, would they? But is he the next best thing?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's the first player to ever score against the top six in one season. But I think so. But with the problem being that one of the sources, perhaps the main source of his goals is Mahrez, the link up he has. Now look through Gareth Southgate's rather threadbare England squad. And who's going to supply the ball for him?
Dele Alli.
Well, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think that just the one poignant thing for me, I really like Leicester. I like what Puyol's doing particularly. I think he's raised their standards. But the type poignant thing is that Mahrez will probably go in the summer and Jamie Vardy's 31. It's just that that's probably, you know, they've done the lead, they've done more than that anybody would have expected them to, but it's probably not too much more for the kind of core of that team.
I think we do just need to give a bit of credit for Morata, who I think had one of the saddest celebrations I think I've seen. Yeah. He's really heartbroken when he scored.
Well, is that not because he got an injury, but then his best friend died in a car crash, and I believe that the celebration was put into this guy to, and sadly, he's waited a long time to do that. Mm.
It was a lovely finish, yeah, and he's we saw at the start of the season, Morata has got so much ability. That just shows you what confidence does for a footballer.
He's just lucky he doesn't play for Jose Mourinho.
Yeah, because there is a bit of the Mourinho tendency in Conte, but he doesn't quite go the full range.
Yeah.
Chelsea in America writes, Kante to Pedro, maybe the shortest goal ever scored. Pedro's 5'6". But it's a big error by Kasper Schmeichel, John, don't you think? And it's one of those, I don't know, some mistakes just don't look that bad. So it didn't look that bad compared to other goalkeeping errors, but I don't know what he's doing there.
No, and Kasper Schmeichel's one of the goalkeepers you'd call pretty safe among Premier League goalkeepers, but it was a rush of blood to the head. And never a good look when you're 6'6" and a 5'6" guy.
Oh, 5'6" and a half. 5'6"
and a half. I was thinking, actually, I saw that tweet about the shortest combinations, and I thought of West Ham back in the 80s. Mark Ward, 5'4.5", and Tony Cotty, who was only 5'6". That was a regular combination. And I actually looked at Frank McAvenny, who you thought was the sort of big man of the combination. He was only 5'7". So West Ham were a small team in their greatest ever season.
Wow, a bit like Barcelona.
Yeah, exactly. Very, very much like Barcelona.
Arguably, Barcelona have based their game on West Ham of the 80s.
Yeah, well, John would be talking about the 86.
85, yeah.
So that was a very good team.
Okay.
Who should have won the league.
And who was in there? Was that Devonshire?
Yes.
Yeah, Devonshire.
McAvenny and Cotty.
Alvin Martin.
Ray Stewart.
Phil Parks, great hair.
Alvin Martin is like, it's like Cocoon. If you look at him now, he looks like, he's like the eternal youth, Alvin Martin.
And whereas not with Phil Parks. I noticed he has some sort of rabble-rousing column to get the West Ham fans up for it, and he looks like he's, you know, his face is melting off.
Well, one of the most disappointing things I've seen is when West Ham's, we bid farewell to the bowling ground, was Alan Devonshire had lost his hair, and I think he had probably the best hair I've ever seen on a footballer, you know, classic trestled sort of feathered look.
He's too much of a man to pay for that, you know, the kind of implant stuff, do you think?
The Glenn Murray.
Yeah.
We'll get on to the Glenn Murray mid-season hair transplant. Do you think the fact we are reminiscing about the 80s of West Ham shows that we as a podcast also don't care about the FA Cup as much as we should, Jacob?
Pretty decent game at Leicester, though. To close it all off on the weekend, I think people suddenly got up for the cup a bit more, and now there's quite an exciting semi-final.
Mm. The draw, yeah, the draw's
United
been,
and Spurs.
United and Spurs is a good draw. We'll talk about those two in just a second. Wigan's run was brilliant, and actually, I don't know if you agree, Jacob. I thought in the first half, you could do an argument that Wigan were the Premier League team and Southampton were the League One team. And actually, this game could quite easily be played in the Championship next year.
Indeed. Well, Southampton, obviously, still, despite being in the semi-finals, are still in huge trouble, still in the bottom three. And I don't think they played very well in the first half. And Wigan having the confidence of, well, that anyone would have after being one of three teams to beat City this season, four teams after Basel, really went at it. And, you know, with the home advantage, it's not always an easy place to play there. They've done similar to Bournemouth and West Ham, and Southampton didn't look very confident under their new manager, but in the end, just that extra bit of class that came through that didn't that you expected City to produce, Southampton produced it, and in the end just had a bit too much for the League One side. But they do look well placed still to go back into the Championship.
It's interesting whether you would choose what Southampton have, which is that morale boosting FA Cup semi-final appearance at Wembley, or what Swansea have, which is one fewer game, one less distraction. Because I think that, I mean, I only listened to the, so I was on my way up to Stoke at the weekend, I only listened to the Spurs game on the radio, but the consistent message about Swansea was they weren't even putting in a shift. So it sounds like, and he kind of rotated his defence, didn't he, as well? So it sounds like maybe he was like, well, okay, this far and no farther.
Do you think Carvajal could do that because it was Spurs and Mark Hughes couldn't really, in his first game, whimper out to Wigan?
Yeah, that's probably true.
Mark Hughes is also chasing history, of course, because he could become the first manager to win the FA Cup, having been knocked out of it. And there's another stat as well, that he could become the third manager to get two teams relegated in a season as well.
Because who is it? Billy McNeil is one. I think Jonathan Wilson said that.
Ron Saunders is the other.
It's Ron Saunders the other. Christian Morton's penalty save was pretty amazing, wasn't it? Because Gabbiadini smacked that ball incredibly hard, Jacob.
Yeah, and he got one hand to it as well.
Jeremy Bowling says, after a weekend where it appeared that lots of penalties were saved, how far actually can a keeper move off his line now before the ball is kicked? Is that just a rule we don't care about anymore?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, there's a few rules like that, like, you know, with a throw-in, how far people walk down the pitch.
Tugging shirts at corners.
Yeah.
How long the keeper has to get rid of the ball.
Yeah. I was just thinking, actually, would VAR stop that in its tracks? You know, that you'd have VAR man in Uxbridge saying, oh, sorry, he moved before the ball was kicked, and then cancelling out great penalty saves like that one.
Quite possibly.
Because VAR just does take the fun out of the game, so yeah. That's very possible.
Since Harry Kane went off against Bournemouth, Spurs have scored 7 and conceded 0. Swansea didn't really show up. Would anybody like to talk about how good Christian Eriksen is?
Well, he did a really good interview in The Independent with Jack Pitbrook, talking about his football brain, and it was in full evidence again. You know, one of those, this time the interview curse didn't strike for a journalist, and instead the footballer turned up, and he got the first, didn't he, with a brilliant goal. Mm-hmm. And as Stuart James wrote, you'd think that Swansea would have realised to close him down by now, given the damage he's done against them in the past. Instead they didn't, and that's what he does. As he proved in the playoff against Ireland, you give him that kind of space, he's going to score. And it just makes that little period without Harry Kane, they've been able to absorb that, which, you know, they had a similar kind of period this time last year as well. And the players like Eriksen and Son stepped it up in the absence of Kane, because I think just before that, when they had that injury previously in November 2016, they really struggled without him. Janssen wasn't able to take up the slack at all. I think the shift towards having Son up there gives them a lot more mobility and enables them to move teams around with much more ease.
But what did he say about his brain specifically?
He knows what to do. He knows when to slow the game down, when to speed it up. He said for him, I think he was saying that goals and assists are one measure of a performance, but it's not the most important thing for him. He knows when he's played well. He's a very interesting character, very clever, and he's still, for someone who's been around so long, he's still young, so he's going to get better and better.
Yeah, just Jacob's completely right. I think just one extra thing is that, you know, in Lamela and Moura, they've effectively got two additional weapons which they haven't had in these previous crises before. And, you know, Moura's hit the ground running for Spurs. Lamela scored the second on Saturday. Not only are they very good players with exactly the right type of skill set that Spurs lacked in certain games earlier on this season, which is the close control, quick sort of burst of pace to get through a kind of tightly packed defensive line, but they're also just, it takes the pressure off those. You don't have to burn Eriksen into the ground in order to try and create chances anymore.
Lamela is very graceful. I don't know how brilliant a footballer he is. I think he's a lovely footballer, but, you know, I don't know what level he's at.
Yeah.
But I just wondered, there are just some players who just every sort of movement they have, even when they're losing the ball, it's just sort of beautiful to see. Do you agree with that, John?
I do, but I also think he's got a bit of... He's quite hard as well. There's a bit of needle to him. I think Pochettino has worked on that side of the game and he gets stuck in. I mean, I think I went to the game against Leicester, which was his comeback after, you know, however long it was out, and he was booked within 5 minutes or so. So that's off. He's learnt to chase after it.
He's got a bit of the Bergkamps about him. He likes to leave a little bit in.
Jim says, following Eric Dyer's elbow sleeve, what is the pod's favourite kit affectation by any player? De Rossi's one long and one short sleeve for me. Does anyone have...
Wasn't there, well, I can't remember who it was, but the guy who put the plus in between the two numbers on his back, so he could cut his old number. Yeah.
1+8.
Any
just the Cantona colours, I suppose, which is the classic.
Yeah. While we're talking, we can move from Cantona to Manchester United, John. And I think we've done quite well to get through this far without talking about Jose Mourinho and not really what anything that's happened on the pitch, but he's had quite a fun few days where he's deconstructed the history of Manchester United and dug out all of his players, apart from the island of personality, Nemanja Matic.
Just before John critiques, I just want to point out, Gogglebox did an entire section on Jose Mourinho's post-match interview against Liverpool.
Oh,
that's the sort of level he's hitting now.
Because I haven't seen Gogglebox for a little bit. Who had the best take?
The German dad, who is a Liverpool fan, and absolutely just kept on going ultra close up on him. He was steaming on every remark he made.
John, have you measured Jose's press conference performances recently?
You're in that position where I've seen this before. I remember when he was Chelsea's manager and it was going wrong. There's a game they lost to Southampton at Stamford Bridge, and he did a 9-minute monologue there, which was a TV interview. 12 is PB, I would say, this time. But the amount of self-justification and debunking of the Manchester United myth, it does look like, the Lowry Hotel better consider that they might not have a single occupant of their massive suite for much longer than this summer, because it looks a bit like he's trying to talk himself out of the job. If we move on to the Luke Shaw situation...
Well, I don't want to go back to, you know, him basically saying that Manchester United aren't that big a club, really.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, though, the classic thing about that is Mourinho likes the idea of being the outsider, the rebel, the small club. I don't think he's ever really got over conquering Europe with Porto. And he managed to, with Inter Milan, one of Italy's biggest clubs, he managed to reduce them to some sort of, you know, Stoke City, sized entity that managed to take on the bad guys of Bayern Munich and all that. And I think small is beautiful for him. And I think that he'd prefer if these clubs were just, you know, that he was essentially, you know, the idea that no man is bigger than a club is complete anathema. It's all about him. And of course, except when it isn't his fault, which of course, Manchester United losing to Sevilla, that could never be his fault, could it?
It worked a bit at Chelsea as well, or for quite a long time, because although they had the Russian billionaire coming in, they hadn't won the league for 50 years. So Mourinho coming in there was the perfect time for somebody to create a siege mentality. Chelsea didn't have a winning mentality at all as a team. He inherited a squad of players who were quite callow in that regard, and he turned them into these hardened, brutal winners. But with Manchester United, it's just you're turning up at a club which is it's one of the biggest clubs in the world. So to start talking about them in those kind of terms, I don't see how long the fans will last with it.
Even though
some supporters on certain social media channels are very sort of taken with the Mourinho conspiracy theories.
Patrice Evra apparently did a recent sort of sponsored trip to Korea. My friend's lives in Korea, big Manchester United fan. His friend was speaking to Patrice Evra. Evra is of the same mind as Mourinho too many players in that dressing room who don't have a winning mentality. And I think, you know, he's a small club man until he starts demanding a champion's mentality from his players, when he then expects them to sort of truly appreciate and understand, you know, that you have to win every game and you have to do everything to win in every moment. My problem is you can keep saying that, and there are obviously players who aren't delivering in those aspects for him, and he's right. But once they do that, what's Mourinho's plan after that? I think, you know, we have got to the point, the sort of second term at Chelsea and at United, he doesn't really have a game plan that can match Manchester City, match Liverpool, or even match Spurs.
I agree with what you say about the football as well, but also you go back to 13 years now when he turned up at Chelsea. It took him 2 seconds to give those players a winning mentality. You look at someone like Frank Lampard, John Terry, they were in a similar kind of position to some of these young players at Manchester United. Yeah. It took him no time at all to get into their heads, and, you know, suddenly he's turning up in the shower with Frank Lampard and telling him he's the best player in the world at the time when people like Ronaldinho were obviously better than him, and he gave him that belief. He doesn't seem to have that connection with the players anymore. You wonder if he can connect to this generation of a footballer, whether they really respond to at all to being told over and over again that they aren't good enough. Reports today that Luke Shaw wants out, and that even the players now are starting to think that Mourinho's bullying Luke Shaw, so, you know, his constant favourite target. And
it's weird, isn't it?
I think the Luke Shaw thing, it's like, you know, it's time to call HR, you know. I mean, that game against Brighton, it seemed that he picked Luke Shaw almost deliberately to take him off at half time and humiliate him. And I don't think actually he was playing that badly. I didn't see anything. I mean, listen, I don't possess the footballing mind of Jose Mourinho, but there wasn't anything there. Things with Luke Shaw. Luke Shaw came on, didn't he, recently in a game against Crystal Palace. And let's just say that the Manchester United away kit did not flatter him. And he didn't look like a Premier League footballer. And we do know that the player has had some psychological issues that have been actually reasonably well publicised. And yet Jose Mourinho keeps picking on him. It really doesn't reflect well on Jose Mourinho. And if Luke Shaw's finally decided that, right, that's it for him and he wants to move on, well, who could possibly blame him for that?
Yeah, Paul Scholes is sitting there going, the guy could be the best in the world. You know, Pochettino might take him off his hands for nothing. Discard Danny Rose. You've got, in the other direction maybe, you've got, what is it, 6 years on? Shaw's 6 years younger?
Yeah.
Even faster? Personal things aside, when you're managing a club as big as Man United, to sort of consistently write off assets like that is also just a professional dereliction of duty.
There are so many assets that he has written off that star in the Premier League these days. I mean, one of them actually is playing okay for him now, Romelu Lukaku, but you've got De Bruyne and Salah, the two best players in the Premier League this season. I think, though, with the Shaw thing, there is that macho thing to Mourinho that appeals to certain Manchester United fans, which that they will say, oh, these players, they're not hard enough, they don't want to win enough. And that there's a certain macho thing that he can appeal to, that people agree with that. And I think that's the element of the Manchester United support that he's still got on their side. Oh, he's right, these players are crap. Problems is that he's bought some of those players. But you just for him to dish it out to players all the time is completely against what we were taught was the conventional wisdom being a football manager.
This idea of hardness, though, I mean, probably a lot of Manchester United fans would go back to the United-Arsenal clashes back in the day and have a lot of nostalgia about that. But within the City team, how many sort of hard players do you think there are?
No. Yeah,
compared to
is that just football is different now?
Yeah, indeed. I think that it's changed. I think that the team that's going to, I mean, probably Real Madrid maybe have the, maybe and Juventus as well, but they're pretty old, some of the players who are within that team who you think they're really hard. But how many hard players are there at Barcelona who are quite possibly going to win the Champions League? The classic idea that you have of the winner that apparently Manchester United don't have. If you put any of those other top managers in the Premier League in charge of that Manchester United team, if you put Pochettino, if you put Klopp there, I'm not saying that they would automatically win the league, but do you not think that they would be getting more right now out of them in an attacking sense?
On the Luke Shaw thing, I once had a manager and we had a game where we arrived with 10 players and 4 were late. But he started with 9 and left Hunter on the bench. So it's not got to that level yet for Luke Shaw. You think if Mourinho only had 11, he'd still pick him.
Didn't Roy Keane do that with some players that turned up late? He just set off without them, you know. But Roy Keane's the classic macho manager, isn't he? That you know, that some United fans want. It's like, right, let's get Keane in to sort this out. Unfortunately, Roy Keane is not a very good football manager.
This is from Mark, who says, I can't understand United's owners, board, shareholder, former greats, lack of defence of the club. Rarely have I seen a manager bad-mouthing his own employer so vigorously, and the fans don't seem to mind either. How would you explain their apathy? Also, from a financial point, hard to believe. Pogba's value's taken a hit. Alexis Sanchez costs nearly 100 grand a day. Global fans are losing interest in these unlovable losers and abandoning the club in droves. It's a massive asset destruction. Nobody seems to ring the alarm. Brackets, I couldn't be happier, though. It's a grand spectacle.
Well, that's what you get when you appoint Jose Mourinho, unfortunately. I mean, other clubs, he brings the success and then he tears it all apart by windmilling in every direction when he doesn't know what to do about it. It may well be that the only success he lands is the Europa League and the League Cup and takes it all down from within.
Do you know who we're going to give the last word on Jose Mourinho to in this pod?
Who?
It is Ralf Werdenwerber from Gogglebox.
There was four situations where was a penalty and the referee have a fucking red shirt on. So fuck the shut up, Mourinho. Shut up, you fucking idiot.
Put the shirt on.
Shut up, you fucking idiot. You know, in the second half, they don't even have a ball, Manchester United.
It's even better than that because he's with his wife and his daughter and they patently don't know who Mourinho is. So not only is he having a rant, these two are just kind of like, what is going on? He's just gone right off the deep end.
Parental advisory. I should have said that before we played that clip. Philip says, any thoughts on Glenn Murray's new haircut? Is it a mid-season hair transplant? I'm not an expert on these things.
I thought he just shaved it all off. He had a sort of like, he looked like he had a number two all over to me when he came on. Didn't play very well. Should have kept his hair on.
Anyway, I don't know.
It was going and now it's returned, I think.
Fair play for just doing it mid-season, isn't it? Producer Jonathan says 100%. I'm not considering it, but I'm starting to thin. And I wonder, you know...
It's not socially acceptable. People didn't give Wayne Rooney the credit he deserved for that action back in the day. He made it... It's like Beckham and tattoos and sarongs. He just made the hair replacement an acceptable thing for a man to do. Well done, Wayne.
Would you have one?
No. I'm old school.
Jacob?
Don't think so.
John?
No.
I don't think I need to
you're,
do
you're
it
in, You're in show business, though, aren't you? So.
Well...
Your hair's your living.
Well, maybe it is... It's sad if that's true. The draw, Manchester United Spurs with an away draw. This is from Glauber, who says, not normally a conspiracy theorist, that's four consecutive away draws in the FA Cup for Spurs. Newport, Rochdale, Swansea. If they beat United, there'll be a flip of a coin away from five away ties on the bounce. Surely there's a fairer way of doing the draw. And Chelsea, Southampton. What's the cup final going to be, Jacob?
Logic, Chelsea, Spurs, but it's very hard to trust Spurs.
Yeah, it's going to be United, Chelsea, isn't it?
I think it is. I loved Spurs. The Spurs absolutely annihilated Manchester United, didn't they? I know they didn't score that many, but was it 2-0? But it could have been about 100. Yeah.
It could be the moment. You know, Pochettino needs a game like this and to win it. But, you know, I thought it was going to happen against Chelsea last year.
I'm going to go for Spurs-Chelsea. Was that a repeat of 1967?
What happened in that one?
Spurs won 3-1.
Ah, great. That'll do for part one. We'll return with the Premier League. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, let's start with Liverpool's 5-0 win over Watford. 28 goals now for Mo Salah. He won't win the PFA Player of the Year, apparently, because the voting's already been done and Kevin De Bruyne's a heavy favourite, which is just a reason why the timing is total madness. We did the London... I'm on the panel voting for the London Football Awards and it's about done in sort of January because there's no date to do it because there's a charity night every Thursday night from sort of February onwards, that Roy Hodgson was voted the manager of the year when Palace could quite easily go down. The idea that why can't we just wait until the season's finished for the players to vote for this? Or should we just not care about it at all?
I'm a member of the Football Writers and we vote much later. And that does tend to be, I think, and I probably would say this, it's a more realistic representation, apart from the time that they voted for Scott Parker.
The year that West Ham went down.
And they got relegated. But, I mean, last year it was Kante, previous year Jamie Vardy. I think those are pretty fair reflections of the season.
Didn't Fergie blow his top because Ginola won in 99?
Yes.
The Football Writers Award over any treble winning
over it was over five or six players that were playing the best scenes of their lives.
Is there anything we can add to how good Mo Salah is?
I think one thing is that when you watch him, that the opposition know what he's going to do, and at this point they can't stop him.
Who's patented that Iron Robin? Who do you reckon's patented the... Everybody knows.
Going to, and we're going to probably name loads of little wingers who cut in onto their left foot, but coming on from Messi. But Robin, yeah, every time inside from the right, he's going to put it into the top corner. Can you stop him?
But he started cutting onto his right as well, Salah. You know, he'll go to the left and then he'll go to the right as well. I mean, the first goal on Saturday, he went both ways.
Miguel Britos is going to be remembered for two things this season, isn't he?
Yeah.
One is that amazing tackle he did on the opening... Was it the opening weekend? And he flew into someone higher than Cantona flew into the Crystal Palace fan. And the other is being put completely on his backside by Mo Salah.
There was something about... maybe it's Watford's, the colour of their shirts, but there's a picture I saw of just Salah turning with the ball and sort of five or six of them going exactly the wrong way. And, you know, like the famous Maradona picture and various ones of Messi.
Iniesta as well is in those photos. But, yeah, he... And again, not to go back to Mourinho, but he gave him no time at all. Well, out after 2 seconds.
Well, they bought him that season, if you remember, because Liverpool wanted him. So Liverpool wanted him the 2013-14 season. They were going for the title. And Brendan Rodgers spotted him and thought he would be a player to augment them. And he probably would have been. And it ended up that Salah played for Chelsea in the 2-0 game that Chelsea at Anfield that stopped Liverpool winning the title. So as far as Mourinho is concerned, job done.
A player scoring 4 goals in a single game in Europe's top 5 leagues has happened just 9 times this season. This weekend, Salah was one of 3 players to do it. Cristiano Ronaldo putting 4 past Jerome Amaro Icardi, doing the same to Sampdoria. Their Champions League draw... Manchester City are the 4th and 10th of April. They're both playing in derbies on the Saturday in between these two legs, and City could win the league in between these two games. Jurgen Klopp not happy about their kickoff time on the Saturday. They face Everton at 12:30. The Manchester derby's at 5:30. He claims the 5-hour difference in terms of recovery is huge. Klopp v Guardiola, 6 wins to Klopp, 5 wins to Guardiola, 1 draw. Are we happy that there's going to be one English team in the semi-final? John, would you rather they were split apart? Do you give Liverpool any chance?
I think the balls were perhaps warm so that the English teams were picked together. Just call that a conspiracy theory in this age of them. Over the two legs, you'd have to back City to go through because they are the better team with better players throughout the departments. But Liverpool... obviously beat them in the league, and you actually go back to the 5-0 defeat. Liverpool were actually playing pretty well until the sending off in that game. So if any team can knock Manchester City out, that is an English team, you'd have to say it would be Liverpool. David Silva, of course, turned it on last week at Stoke, but I don't think City are quite at the apex that they were, towards the end of last year.
It's like Bayern Munich, it's just too easy for them, and so they can't win the competitive games at the end of the season.
Yeah, which was always a problem for Guardiola in Germany. We talked about De Bruyne before. De Bruyne is not quite at his best. He's not playing badly, but he's not playing in a way that made him the overriding PFA Player of the Year whenever they voted for it back in October or whatever.
Yeah. Whereas Liverpool are, they're having to fight for this Champions League play, so each week they're having to bring a performance.
Juve, Real, Barcelona, Roma, Sevilla, Bayern Munich. Are we excited? Are you excited about the ties, Jacob?
Yeah, but I think you can already start to make a good guess for what the semi-finals are going... Well, who's going to be in the semi-finals.
So do you subscribe to John's conspiracy theory?
No, but if my hunch does come to pass, then it would be another year where you'd have the two... top Spanish teams and the best team in Germany, and then City for the second time, but one of the richest teams again, which I think is going to become a problem for the Champions League in terms of the interest that it's generating.
Do you? I mean, I sort of wonder that by the time you get to the quarterfinals, it will always be just a selection of great clubs playing against each other. But you think they're just, because it just will always be the same teams?
I think you had a spell where it was Barcelona, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, one other.
Yeah.
In the semi-finals.
Now, yeah.
Juventus, who are getting in there, but obviously at least one of them are going to go out. And for a while, it was Manchester United or Chelsea who would join them. who would join them there, and you had Atletico who would jump in at times. But I think that just that, although they're great games, I think that it does lead to a bit of deja vu.
Well done to Arsenal, who saw off AC Milan. They did most of the work in the San Siro. John, did you enjoy Danny Welbeck's dive? I mean, it was almost not even a dive. He almost just went down and looked at the fifth official and went, how about it?
It was apologetic, wasn't it? One of those things that led to one of those Twitter storms that you get. Now, whenever a player from one club does something like that, everybody immediately switches their focus to fans of a rival club, to another club, and points out. So it just ended up this Danny Welbeck versus Dele Alli diving thing.
I was on the wireless the next day.
Yes.
When this precisely happened. It's ridiculous.
And we live in this world of whataboutery, don't we, where, you know, what about what they did? Well, it's like, well, it doesn't really matter because they weren't playing in that game. But Dele Alli has dived, it is true, but so did Danny Welbeck. And that pretty much was the end of the debate for me.
Mm. Well, Dele Alli wasn't there in this game.
No.
Because he doesn't play for either of these teams.
No, but the debate seems to be, why are you all focusing on him doing it when Dele Alli does it? It's completely nonsensical.
Anyway, Arsenal have been drawn against CSKA. Arsenal have encouraged their supporters to follow advice from the Foreign Office. Obviously, this tie comes at a time of tension between the government and the Kremlin over the poisoning of the Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter with a nerve agent in Salisbury this month. You wonder, Johnny, some fans may not travel, but a lot of fans will go, won't they?
Yeah, I mean, you should never underestimate, you could call it the foolhardiness of some fans, or you might call it the resolve of some fans to go to as many games as possible. English clubs have travelled to Russia many times over without problems, so I imagine many people would take that view and go. I know Stuart James is going to that game and he's decided... Yeah. It's... I don't know. I mean, if the boot was on my foot, I'd be wary. But in Stuart's case, it's work. If you're an Arsenal fan and a total diehard, you'd probably go.
The rest of the ties, Atletico Madrid versus Sporting Atletico, the favourites for the Europa League. Lazio play Salzburg, RB Leipzig against Marseille. Back to the Premier League, Bournemouth 2, West Brom 1. West Brom have lost 24 points from leading positions in the top flight this season. That's quite a lot, more than any other team. Bournemouth have picked up 16 from losing positions, more than any other side. The way you all laughed at the West Brom stat makes me feel that none of you have any sympathy for West Brom.
Well, that's just more points. They've lost more points than they've actually got. I don't know. I don't feel that. I don't have that much of a problem with Pardew, and I don't feel that, you know, I think there's some decent players in that West Brom side. I think they've just played their cards wrong at the wrong times and they haven't got it together. But I think it's kudos to... You know, it's kudos to Eddie Howe. I've always puzzled me about what it is that Bournemouth do that's good, that sort of keeps them above that. And I think it really is their mentality. And, you know, that stat you just quoted there.
It's funny because that stat really surprised me, because I have this image that they're all, you know, they're soft and they're not.
And, well, I think, you know, they're not physical, but they are, you know, I think they're resilient. And I think that's what he conveys to those players.
I think there's a case for West Brom having the worst ever Premier League season. Because if you look at those sort of, you know, classic teams that have descended, you know, like Sunderland and over two seasons, their club's in total crisis. Derby, yeah. Derby came up when they were expecting to and, you know, went through a series of managers. But you looked at West Brom at the start of the season, they had the ultimate safe as houses manager. They started buying players of international class, or adding players like Kukoviak, you know, Kieran Gibbs and stuff like that. And then they've just completely failed and has been ill-disciplined.
And they won their first two games.
Well, that's right. At that point, everyone's talking about Pulis the genius. So, you know, the fall from grace has been, you know, I can't really remember anything quite like it. And, you know, when they go into a winning position against Bournemouth, no one really expects them to get the job done. And, you know, I mean, it was Ben Foster making mistakes on a pretty bad weekend for English goalkeepers. You know, they really have been utterly, utterly dreadful.
you've made a very convincing argument there.
I mean, I'm trying to think of bad teams in the Premier League era. There's a couple of Leicester teams, and there was Ipswich that got beaten 9-0, but none of them were as bad. Even Swindon, 93-94. This has been an utter...
It's relegation as well is going to hurt Pardew, his reputation, so much. Because if you think back to... Well, if you go back to, say, December 2015, Palace were sixth or something like that in the Premier League, and... They went to Stoke and they won, and people were talking about them possibly. And this was the season where Leicester won the league. West Ham and Southampton were challenging for Champions League, and Palace were right up there.
Well, he was the next England manager as well.
At that point, yeah, it was Pardew. He got to the cup final as well, did his dance when they scored. But now he's taken over this team with
dance.
It really has, and he's got sacked by Palace. Very soon after that, and he's taken over West Brom mid-season, and you've seen other managers have, like Hodgson, who came a bit earlier, have revitalising effects on their teams, but he just seems to have done absolutely nothing at all.
And you're in this situation where they're not going to sack him because they know that the situation is irretrievable. So it's just like, we've only got him to the end of the season, we'll just pay him off then. So he's just living, he's sort of dying on the vine. It's quite painful
and
to watch.
He's quite young as well, but the next job that he's going to get at this point, you would think, would have to be a team who have taken so many wrong turns that they'll be so desperate that it can only be Pardew. You know,
Sunderland. Like
West Ham, oh right, we're going to get Moyes at this point. I know Moyes has done a good job, but when he came, it was completely toxic. And he'll be such a toxic choice for whoever takes him next.
Apparently, Michael Appleton is the favourite candidate to take West Brom over.
Michael Appleton has managed some quite odd clubs. When he went to Blackburn when they were falling apart, he went to Oxford United, a troubled club. He went to Portsmouth, one of the crisis clubs, and now he's got to West Brom.
He's got quite a cushy number right now as well, working with Claude Puel in a club that's going places.
That might be a popular choice though, because he played there, and I think the fans now hate Pardew so much that they might as well just cut their losses.
And
maybe at the point at which they get relegated.
Yeah, and there's something quite good about just how massive Michael Appleton is.
Yeah. I think he would be the only Football League manager with a neck tattoo as well, which I think that's an achievement.
Yeah, kudos to him. Huddersfield 0, Crystal Palace 2. Here's a good stat, which I hope is accurate. Crystal Palace without Wilfried Zaha this season, played 9, won 0, drawn 0, lost 9, 4-3 against 21. So much as we credit Roy Hodgson, essentially Wilfried Zaha is Crystal Palace.
He is.
Yeah, I mean, he is and he isn't. I mean, he is by far their best player. He makes them tick. He makes the difference. He can create things out of nothing. But Palace would be relegated by now if Hodgson hadn't got the rest of the team organised and fighting for each other and playing, as a cohesive unit upon which, they provide a platform for Zaha to go on and do what he does.
I love Zaha. Just never stops as well. I mean, back in October, where he's still going in the 97th minute against West Ham and scoring a brilliant equaliser, which gets them a point, which in this tighter league, but he just keeps going the whole time. And you wonder now, would this be the summer for him to leave? Has he got the mentality now to succeed at where he wasn't able to at Manchester United a few years ago?
I think a close, I don't know what the technical term is, but if somebody with the ball at his feet, one-on-one, trying to beat a man, I don't think there's anybody better in the Premier League than Zaha.
Sane?
I think Sane is brilliant, and maybe they're on a similar level, but Sane uses his pace an awful lot, goes out the outside. Zaha likes to stand it up and just he'll do two or three of them at once regularly.
So who gets him? Where does he go?
Well, it would have been Spurs a couple of seasons ago, but I think Spurs are quite well stocked now after buying Moura. I'm not sure if Moura was that buy.
Well, I fear for him if he goes to Manchester United and Jose Mourinho. They do want a right-sided winger, actually, so that spells doom.
How much do we fear for Huddersfield? 15th, so there's sort of 3 points off the relegation zone. Haven't won in three.
They've played badly quite a lot of the season, but there's this sort of idea that when you write them off, they pull out a good performance. Now, that's on the one hand quite, you know, yeah, they can do it when they're back up against the wall, but can you keep relying on that to happen? It all depends on what Hughes manages to do with Southampton, I think, and whether West Ham implode.
They're in the midst of, do you think Stoke are done after Saturday?
Yeah, I think I wrote my talking point and I maybe overwrote it a bit. I said that's it.
Yeah, that's it for Stoke.
Yeah, and that's partly because I didn't look through the fixture list properly and only had them down with six games left rather than seven, the last game being against Swansea. But they play Arsenal, Spurs and Liverpool. They also play Burnley. They're on 27 points. They're definitely not going to get to 40. In my opinion, it might be less than that you need to stay up. I think they're a decent, they're actually playing quite decent now, but not brilliant. And I think it just might be a little bit too far.
Stoke City 1, Everton 2. You were there, Paul, but I don't know if you were, it was too much snow in between you and Charlie Adams' tackle to have any idea from where you were if he deserved to go on.
Like the referee, I thought Jerdan Shaqiri had done it, but I think in retrospect, it's an even worse decision to do it. At the time, I was inclined to give him a break because the pitch was dangerous at that time, and it was difficult to keep your feet, and it was difficult to see what was going on. But that's even less reason to go in and make a jumping studs out, you know, tackle on somebody. And it was, you know, it was on the edge of Everton's own box as well. There was absolutely no need to do it. I think it was. That's the sort of, you know, Lambert saying after the game, got to cut out mistakes, got to stop making mistakes. You know, I was listening to Hughes saying that at Palace in November. You know, they haven't stopped that. They've got more cohesion about them. I think Badu and Dai is sort of player they needed in that midfield to release Joe Allen. He's their best player. Shaqiri and Allen are best players. But it's when you make those sort of... And then again, you know, get back to 1-1 with 10 men... And then kind of go, okay, the goal scorer forwards got injured in the process. 1-1, 15 minutes to go. What do I do? Stick on Hesse. Like, that is the sort of belief over experience, I think. And then they go, they get done on the counter. There's the defenders are too tired to close down the thing. The marking's bad. Butland doesn't do well enough. Goal.
I liked how fast Charlie Adam ran off the pitch. After he'd gone to check if Wayne was all right, he basically sprinted, didn't he?
I've never seen him run as fast as that.
It was cold, though. He thought, well, my day's done.
He's the classic strolling midfielder. And then suddenly he's running like Wilfred Zaha off the field.
Credit to the Everton fans who clearly got nothing to play for. And they'd lost, what, five in a row away from home? They look like they're having a great time.
Yeah, they've brought the noise, big numbers.
And actually, you know, that sort of explains that, you know, the point of football often isn't actually the football, you know. It's the whole idea of travelling away with Everton. Certainly, since their season has essentially been over, there's no actual point in doing it, apart from you have a nice day out.
And to be fair, you know, Stoke have had an awful season, but their crowd was big and noisy as well. They were there, it was freezing cold and they were up for it.
We've touched on the England squad. Stuart James on Sunday Supplement called it as weak as I can remember it. Does anybody agree with that? Giving the opportunity to Nick Pope seems like a good idea. And, you know, James Tarkowski seems like a good idea. They have a good season. It's Alfie Mawson from Swansea, Lewis Cook from Bournemouth. But it doesn't shine out at you, does it?
Well, if the World Cup is in June, it seems, you know, to be experimental with what that squad looked like. That looked like the type of squad that would fly to a, you know, friendly tournament in Malaysia or something on a off year. I saw that Gary Cahill's dropped, which, you know, he hasn't been playing well and hasn't been in the team quite a lot. But the centre-halves, Tarkowski's a decent player, but Burnley haven't been great for a while. So you've got John Stones, who's out of the team, Harry Maguire, who's a good player, but pretty inexperienced at that level, Tarkowski, Joe Gomez, who can sort of play centre-half, and Alfie Mawson, who I think is a good player. But there's, you know, I think the thing with Southgate is he's very critical of centre-backs, having been a centre-back himself. So Cahill's gone. He's already decided that Chris Smalling can't play the style of football that he wants. But he hasn't got any centre-backs in the squad that I think can do the job.
Who would be your three? Who would be your starting three, John? Not from that squad? No. Like all England, all English defence. We're playing three at the back.
Well, I'm just glad I'm not Gareth Southgate, I suppose, at that point. It's very difficult
to play Stones, Maguire and Phil Jones. But
Jones is injured, isn't he now?
Yeah.
I think I'd still have Cahill in there because he plays in that system and has won a lot of titles.
He has won a lot of titles, but he's been a liability for England as well. You can sort of understand it from both sides. I think the thing about, you know, the weakest England squad kind of seen for some time, I kind of do think that sometimes we look at things in retrospect and we see things in rose-tinted glasses, and then we also sort of, you know, is it the sort of ability as defined by kind of people who watch it, or is it winning stuff that matters? This squad is definitely inexperienced, but he is saying that he wants to play a particular way and he wants to pick players who are in form, and to a certain extent, you know, this is sort of, you know, given the options he has with injuries and players being excluded, this is probably true to that idea at least.
But Jake Livermore, why?
Is he in the squad?
He's in the squad.
Oh, right. Well, yeah. I mean, he's played well for Southgate at England, but yeah.
Jake, you know, when we think of Jake Livermore being present in the worst team ever, what are his achievements? Are being in the back of a borrowed taxi?
Well, he might have been in the front.
Well, maybe. But he doesn't drive him.
No, but he may have got the front seat.
With the McDonald's.
Of course, he wasn't particularly impressive in the Brazil friendly. I think he just sort of annoyed Neymar a lot by kicking him.
Yeah. That's probably what he's there to.
See, that's what I mean. There was a case for another ball playing midfielder over Livermore, like Shelvey or Winks. I know Winks hasn't really played. Southgate sort of said he wanted to pick players who were only people who were playing, but that's he's realised you can't just do that because you've got to pick some people who aren't first team regulars.
Winks is really good as well if he's fit, but if he's not playing for Spurs, I think there's easily a case to bring him along despite Southgate's apparent rule over players who have to be playing.
Given we have seemingly some perspective on how good this squad is, come June, will we all forget all of that and start plotting England's way to the final?
I think the lack of actual world, you know, the with Harry Kane being the only world-class player in the squad and him being out injured, there's not going to be much to build an awful lot of hype around. And I do think the problem is, you know, what the media do with it as much as anything else. But, you know, if we play well in the group stages, then it'll be gung-ho and then we'll get beat.
I saw in this squad that the top scorer amidst that squad is Danny Welbeck, and the second top scorer is Ashley Young, who that presumably is his days when he played as a forward or left-sided forward.
Or number 10.
Yeah.
He's played all over the place.
Yes, and now he's a left-back.
And he presumably is England's starting left-back, isn't he? Because Danny Rose has done virtually nothing this year.
Unless Jake Livermore plays there, then.
Yeah, that's a good point. Aaron Ramsey's not available for Wales. Ryan Giggs has picked a few uncapped and young players for their trip to the China Cup. Brentford's Chris Meppham, Swansea defender Connor Roberts, Preston midfielder Billy Bowden, and Ipswich goalkeeper Michael Crowe will make the trip. Is Billy Bowden son of penalty misser Paul Bowden? He is. I feel sorry for Paul Bowden. It's the only thing I think any football fan knows about him. Keep it down. Some more international news. Ravel Morrison is on the way to becoming a Jamaican international. He played for England at youth level, hasn't made the grade since then. He's on loan at Mexican team Atlas after his move to Lazio failed to catch a light. He's apparently keen to play for the Reggae Boys.
In terms of the England midfield debate, if he had actually stuck with it and applied himself, he would be in that side and you wouldn't necessarily be worried so much to quite the extent that we are about the lack of creativity, because... He was there.
Yeah, he was
5 years ago. He was in the West Ham side and scoring that solo goal at Spurs.
He was the best young player in a team with Jesse Lingard and Paul Pogba. They all thought he was the best player, and you know he chose another path. Let's put it that way.
There's that brilliant youth cup game at Anfield where he scores an amazing goal. In front of the cop, brilliant volley. And I think he gets sent off. I think he gets sent off, though, for something ridiculous. I think he got sent off for stuttering his run-up for a penalty and chipping the keeper. I think that's right. But he got a second booking for unsportsmanlike behaviour. But that's how good he was.
Oh, really?
No, no, that wasn't the moment for... There were lots of other things that have gone on with Ravel. But it's just interesting that he's not... He's still playing football. And he's had a lot of teams. He's gone to a lot of places. He went to Lazio for a bit of time. He had the loan at QPR. He's had various loans in the Championship. And now he's playing in Mexico. It's not like he's drifted off and he isn't still playing. He's still trying to do it. And now he's trying to play international football for another country. But he must be one of the biggest wasted talents for how good he could have been over the last 5, 10 years.
Some credit that he's still trying to play and not on reality TV.
Yeah, that's the surprising... That's the disappointment with him. That
he's not on reality TV.
Well, at least if he'd done that, then... But this is just all a bit drab for how good he could have been.
Oh, well.
He should be... Well, I mean, Mourinho would have hated him, but he should be Manchester United's number 10 and...
He's no Scott McTominay.
No.
In the Football League, despite the weather, the only postponed game in the Championship... and one of only two Football League games called off was Sunday's match between Derby and Cardiff. Neil Warnock was incensed with the decision, taking just 3.5 hours before kickoff, calling it scandalous, hinting that Derby may not have minded given the injury crisis at Pride Park. Gary Rowett only had 10 fit senior players at training on Friday. The game looks like it'll be rescheduled for April, causing a bit of a headache for Warnock as they're already set to face the teams in 9th, 1st and 4th in the space of just 9 days. In what could make or break the... Bluebirds' chance of promotion. Sunderland lost again. So Wolves won, this time 3-1 at home to Burton. They're 13 points clear of third with 8 games to go. Just 4 wins will get them promoted. Sunderland lost again, 2-0 at home to Preston. In between the goals came something which kind of sums up their season. Jake Clark-Salter, defender on loan from Chelsea, was sent off during their 3-3 draw against Middlesbrough, had a 3-match ban, returned for this game, got a yellow card in the first half. Then as Chris Coleman was apparently getting ready to take him off, he pulled an opposition back in the middle of the park in a completely unnecessary foul, got his second yellow. That makes it 6 red cards for Sunderland and Chris Coleman's 22 games in charge. 4 wins, 5 draws, 13 defeats. Not only that, at half-time in their game, there was a crossbar challenge taken by a group of volunteers who'd walked from Bournemouth to Sunderland to raise money for the Bradley Lowry Foundation. The winner was wearing a Newcastle United shirt, celebrated by wheeling away, doing the Shearer celebration, and nutmeg the steward who came to confront him. And in slightly more serious news, they've suspended midfielder Darren Gibson after he was charged with drink driving.
He was the guy who was filmed by a fan in a bar completely blotto, wasn't he?
Last year, last summer. Complaining about other players' attitudes.
Yeah. Anyway. Barry and Jonathan Wilson are back to do more Sunderland corner soon. In League One, the only postponement was Gillingham's meeting with top of the table Blackburn. That allowed Shrewsbury to cut the gap to just 2 points with a 2-1 win at Scunthorpe, their third win in a row. They've got a game in hand too. Third place Wigan have 3, all thanks to that FA Cup run. Just think about games in hand. I don't know about anyone else, but when Cambridge have them, I automatically add on 3 points for every game in hand. At no point do I think we won't win every possible game in hand. Is that just me, or is that
every football fan? Ham's is against Manchester United, so obviously
you've added on three.
Yeah, three, yeah.
Unless Mourinho chooses to park the bus, in which case it might be quite difficult to break through.
Yeah. We're going to just 5 points off the top, face Walsall on Wednesday. MK Dons in 22nd, only one of two bottom half teams to win. They're second on the bounce to take them 1 point away from safety. In League Two, 5 score draws, second place Luton drew 1-1 with Newport. Third place Notts County conceded a 99th minute equaliser from the penalty spot to share the points with Mansfield, all of which leaves Accrington Stanley, who got their fourth win in a row, 3-1 at home to Forest Green, 3 points clear at the top with a game in hand. Phil Brown's first game in charge of Swindon ended in a 3-1 win at the mighty Cambridge. He dedicated the win to former West Ham and Bolton player Matt Taylor, who presided over a single game as interim coach, has been helping Brown in his first week. He said, "I've bled him dry this week. I've sucked everything out of him." That's what Phil said about Matt Taylor, which is perhaps how he gets his colour, sucking it out of other human beings. Barnet, bottom of League Two, lost to Wickham. They've sacked Graham Wesley, replacing him with Martin Allen. Emotional Totsvig says, "Has any sitcom character made more returning guest appearances than Martin Allen at Barnet? It's his 5th time in charge of the club." Jim says, "Few thoughts, please, on the mad goings on at Barnet. Not sure I can take a 5th spell of Martin Allen. It's exhausting. When we panic, we call Allen." Do you want to hear his years of charge? 2003-4, 2011, 2012 caretaker, 2014 to 2016, and 2018 now.
Adebayo Akinfenwa.
Mm-hmm.
Joint fourth in the league in League Two for scoring, and second in the league for assists behind Matt Taylor of Swindon.
Well done, the beast.
Neat touch for a big man.
Indeed. And Cov are up in the playoffs now as well.
Which is good touch for a big man is the cliche.
Well, I just started to mess with the formula. Exactly. That's all.
You coined your own phrase for Akinfenwa. Fit bar corner. Chris Boyd's second half goal gave Kilmarnock a 1-0 win over Rangers, his former side at Ibrox. On Sunday, Celtic were held to a goalless draw at Motherwell. Celtic 10 points clear with the game in hand. Aberdeen just 2 points behind Rangers, also with a game in hand. Rangers centre-back Russell Martin was trending this morning. Did anyone see this? A video from a week ago of him being on the end of sectarian abuse in a supermarket. People. It's one of those things, he said. It's the first time it's happened. Don't think it's a regular occurrence for any of the lads. It is what it is. I didn't think anything of it until I got a phone call about it. It's disappointing, but not indicative of the people up here.
Poor guy.
It's interesting on what footballers have to put up with and that sort of... John Nicholson's written an article about the Jamie Carragher thing about, you know, the sort of the intensity, just constant...
Yeah. I mean, I think the Carragher thing doesn't excuse. But Russell Martin, I mean, just he has been, he was... on loan from Norwich, and he's been at Norwich all the way up through the leagues in the Premier League, and he has received more abuse than any player I can think of for, you know, at the time I've been a fan of City, because he was deemed to be not quite good enough at the top level. And he's a guy who wears his heart on his sleeve, gives 100% every day, sometimes fails, and he just you must sometimes wonder whether it's worth it.
The most abuse I ever saw a player receive was I went to the 2004 FA Cup final, and Alfie Inge Haaland was working for Norwegian TV and unwisely decided to make his way to the stadium along a street of Manchester United fans who sang Kino, Kino, Kino for this, you know that sort of big stretch of pubs in Cardiff. That was a bad choice of direction.
For having the temerity to have
his leg nearly broken off, yeah.
It's just a tiny minority, isn't it?
Well, there was only like 20,000 did it that day, so yeah.
It's tiny. Right, that'll do for part two. We'll start part three with Sid. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly. Let's begin in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you this Monday?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, very jolly, thanks. A couple of weeks ago, you told us there is league. But surely now...
there is not.
There isn't league after Atletico were beaten.
No, I mean, in truth, obviously, we were saying then, weren't we, that it was tight and it depended on... or probably depended on Atletico getting something out of Barcelona. Of course, they were defeated by Barcelona, which extended the lead at the top to 8 points. And he thought, well, it's close to being done. I think it now feels even closer or pretty much already done. Although the response to it kind of suggests that people had already given up. You know, that this kind of didn't matter last night. But... if it wasn't already over, it is now. They were defeated 2-1 by Villarreal. That puts them 11 points, which is effectively 12 points behind Barcelona, because Barca have a better head-to-head goal difference, which obviously can't be changed now. They'd have to claw back 12 points to win the league. And there's only 9 games left. They need Barcelona to lose 4 times in the last 9 games. It's a Barcelona team who haven't lost all season. Now, the running is actually quite tough for Barcelona. Of course, there's Champions League games in a way and so on, but it feels like it's over. And you look at the way that the response has been last night, everyone said, right, any doubt that we had, it's gone.
Barcelona did the business against Athletic Bilbao. Fans chanting for Iniesta to stay after a week of speculation about a move to China.
Yeah, and the truth is they can chant, but I don't think it's necessarily going to change very much. I think Iniesta has said that he's got until the 30th of this month to make a decision. He has offers from China. He's very conscious of how his departure is handled at Barcelona. He wants to go out being useful. He doesn't want to hang around and have a final season like Xavi had, where he's not playing very much. And he doesn't want to stay in Europe. He doesn't want to run the risk of having to play against Barcelona. So obviously, there's still a little bit of time to go. There's just over a month before that decision has to be communicated. But the very strong sensation of people close to him is that ultimately he will probably decide to go. He is of a mind to go at the moment. I guess maybe, you know, some chanting at him up, begging him to stay might make a difference. Some sense of a club saying, look, you know, you're still good enough. You can still produce for us. You can still play a very significant role might help. But I suspect probably not.
Yeah, I kind of got the feeling that he would just stay and play a bit less and then become a coach and that kind of thing.
Well, that's fundamentally what he doesn't want to do. And that's kind of the point, in a way, that he wants to go at the top. He wants the final memories of him and the final sense of his departure to be the best it possibly can be. Obviously, he knows that there's a very, you know, almost certain Barcelona win the league. They're in the Copa del Rey final. So, you know, he could go with a double. They're still in the Champions League. He could even go with a treble. And I think that's the way that he wants it to end. And he doesn't want that kind of gradual phasing out. Now, he knows that at some stage there will be some sort of role to play at Barcelona in the future, probably some kind of ambassadorial role rather than coaching, which may not be what he's naturally most got the attributes for. But, you know, in the meantime, he wants to play. And there is, of course, a financial element to this, which is you can go to China, have one last big contract in it, and it would be absolutely enormous for him in a way in which he would believe wouldn't sully in any way his kind of Barcelona legacy.
Real Madrid, in their last 14 games, have just kept one clean sheet. Conceding 19, but they score a lot, so they're sort of quite fun at the moment.
Yeah, they are a lot of fun at the moment. Last night was brilliant against Girona. They won 6-3, and you know, the game was kind of a bit wild at times. Girona are genuinely a good side and caused them a lot of problems. And as you say, there was a focus, you know, afterwards on you know, you have to be concerned about conceding this many goals, and particularly the nature of the goals, largely in the air. They've been vulnerable from set plays this year. Obviously, that's the kind of thing Juventus will be looking at. And everything is conditioned now by the Champions League, not by the league title. You can see that, for example, in the way that Madrid press are making a kind of a title race now of the top scorer award, which is almost like an implicit admission that the league itself has long gone. And one of the reasons why they're doing that, of course, is because Ronaldo is playing so astonishingly well. I mean, last night he scored four goals last night. So in other words, last night he scored as many goals as he scored in the whole of the first half of the season. And that's slightly more significant than it is in England. So the Spanish league is split into two identical halves. In other words, at the halfway stage, you have played everyone once. And at the halfway stage, Cristiano Ronaldo only had four goals. He scored as many goals last night as he scored in the whole of the first half of the season. We're halfway through the second half of the season, and he's now on 22 league goals. It's extraordinary the rate he's scoring at now. Zidane was talking about him coming good when you really need it in a big stage of the season. Now, of course, the nature of a league means, well, when you really need it, the fact that they're so far behind is partly because he wasn't there when they needed him earlier in the season. But from a Madrid's point of view, of course, the key thing is that he's in fantastic form, scoring loads and loads of goals as they go into the quarters, semis, and maybe final as well of the Champions League.
He's the second highest goal scorer in La Liga, isn't he? But he's only scored in 11 matches. It's quite ridiculous.
Yeah, because as I say, it's been racked up since the turn of the year. Basically, it's then that he started scoring goals. I think I'm right in saying that it's 19 in his last 8 games.
Wow, that's ridiculous. What about Sevilla? They lost 2-1 at Leganés. Were they just sort of hung over, or just
they weren't very good? I mean, the truth is they've not been. I mean, this is a difficulty when you try and obviously in all of this there's a kind of Man United in the back of all of our minds when we talk about Sevilla, and it's quite difficult to properly analyse Sevilla because they've largely been okay but not good this year in Spain. For example, Montella took over and there is a sense that things have improved with him. They got to the Copa del Rey final, of course they went to Old Trafford and won, but he's actually lost more games than he's won in La Liga. Sevilla played okay-ish with the ball at Leganés. I was there on Sunday morning, but they didn't create anything, and they looked vulnerable. And you know, in part there's a fatigue element, and Montella said that partly the players are tired. But you know, it's his choice not to rotate ever. I mean, they're basically playing more or less the same starting 11 almost every game now.
Is it ridiculous and upsetting for Man United fans to compare the budgets of Leganés and Manchester United?
Yes, it would be extremely upsetting, I imagine, to do that because Leganés are a team. I think I actually went through this about a couple of weeks ago, and I can't honestly remember, but Leganés are certainly in the bottom three for budget in the first division in Spain. Their budget will be around about, I'm speaking off the top of my head, but I won't be far wrong, be around about 45 million euros. Their annual budget. I'm guessing, but I don't know this, that United's will be closer to 600 or 700.
And the reaction for Sevilla's win was, how did it go down in Spain?
Well, I mean, it's twofold. Obviously, there was the excitement and the sense of glorying in how well Sevilla had done, because this is historic for them. They'd not been in the quarterfinal of the European Cup for 60 years, and last time they were knocked out by Alfredo Di Stefano's Real Madrid, so that kind of tells you which generation we're talking about. And they tried it three times and been knocked out each time. I think Fenerbahce, Leicester, and CSK Moscow. They knew that this hadn't actually been a particularly good season, but this was a chance to do something really big. And genuinely in Spain, there's a real sense of Old Trafford being a special place and United being an enormous club, and this being a huge feat to go there and win. All of that, of course, is slightly tempered by the way that United played, because there is an interest in English football, and of course in Spain there's an interest in Jose Mourinho. So while there was an awful lot of praise for Sevilla, there was also an enormous, enormous amount of criticism for Mourinho, and some of it quite gleeful, because in truth, there are a lot of people in Spain who are waiting for this and waiting for this chance. And so he took quite a kicking as well.
Sid, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Sid Lowe, out in Spain. We will cross from Sid's house to Paolo Bandini's toilet with an update on Serie A.
Well, now, who didn't see this coming? After 12 consecutive league wins, Juventus had the chance to go 7 points clear at the top of Serie A on Saturday night, but instead they were held to a goalless draw by relegation-threatened Spal. There were 50 points between the two teams at kickoff, but you wouldn't have known it from the way that Leonardo Semplici's team got stuck into the Bianconeri, with Pasquale Scatarella leading a ferocious high press while the back three totally swamped Gonzalo Higuain and Paulo Dybala, playing them out of the game. It is a result that breathes fresh life into the title race, obviously. Instead of going 7 points clear at the top, Juve have seen their advantage trimmed to just 2 points by the end of the weekend after Napoli beat Genoa 1-0 with a goal from Raul Albiol. But this is also a huge result for Spal, who have stuck by Semplici, who is the man who led them to consecutive promotions just to reach the top flight. And bear in mind, again, they're playing for the top flight for the first time in 50 years. During a grim middle part of this season, when they pretty much looked nailed on for relegation, they now find themselves back 1 point clear of the relegation zone after taking two wins and two draws in the last four matches, and they're back very much in that fight. So worth paying some credit for Semplici and what he's doing there, as well as recognising what's happening at the top of the table. Now elsewhere, Mario Cardi scored four goals, more than he'd hit in the past 3.5 months, as Inter thrashed Sampdoria 5-0, and along the way he became the sixth youngest player ever to reach 100 goals in Serie A. Meanwhile, Andre Silva, having failed to score a single league goal in his first 7 months at Milan, grabbed his second winner in as many games, sealing a 3-2 win over Chievo. The Rossoneri, who began the year in the bottom half of the table, are now up to within 5 points of the Champions League places, and things are going to get really interesting after the international break, because their next four games are Juventus, Inter, Sassuolo, and then Napoli, all in the space of 16 days.
Thank you, Paolo. And now, for a special treat, we can go live to Germany and Archie Rintutt. Archie, where do we find you?
You find me, Max, in Lucas Podolski's kebab house.
Yes.
Here in the south part of Cologne, which is not too far away, actually, from where a mural of Podolski is. But yes, it's quite loud in here with music and whatnot, but there's not much seating either. But I've managed to steal a seat and sit down with a kebab.
Oh, excellent. So what time is it over there right now?
It is just past 1 o'clock. And actually, in the 20 minutes that I've been sitting in here, there have been around about 100 people who have kind of come through and got their lunchtime kebab here. Not much on offer, I would say. You've got the choice of a beef or a chicken kebab. But I think keeping it simple is the idea. And to be fair, given the popularity of it, I think it's working at a mere €4.50 for your lunch.
Oh, and it, for you personally, is a 1 p.m. kebab too early?
I mean, generally, yes. I prefer it to have around about 12 hours later. But I would say that on the taste test, it passes. In terms of how it holds together, not quite as good, but I guess the ultimate test is whether it stays down, and that's something that we'll have to wait. But so far, so good. I'm halfway through.
Give us a lowdown. What happened in Germany since you're here?
Oh, I might as well. Well, we had a really big game at the weekend in Leipzig against Bayern Munich, which Leipzig won by 2-1, and quite a bit of a statement performance as well, because they've been struggling recently in terms of getting up in and around the Champions League places. This result puts them back in touch. And also, they really outplayed Bayern Munich as well. For the first half, they had 12 shots to Bayern Munich's one. Naby Keita in particular had a very good game, scored one as well. And so did Timo Werner, who's been under a little bit of pressure as he's not been in the goals as much as last season. Should also mention Hamburg as well, because things are not going too well there. In fact, they actually appointed a coach last week called Christian Titz. And things at the weekend did indeed actually go tits up, because they went ahead against Hertha and then they conspired to lose 2-1, meaning that they're on the bottom of the table, because Cologne, of all clubs, who have been appalling for most of the season, actually beat Leverkusen in the Rhine derby. So that means that Cologne still have a shot at survival. They're 5 points off. Mainz are in the relegation playoff, along with Wolfsburg, who are just above them on goal difference merely. But Leipzig-Bayern, probably the biggest headline of the weekend. Dortmund, Schalke, both winning slenderly, if not performing all that well. And the big surprise package is Eintracht Frankfurt, because they are having their best season in 24 years. They won again 3-0 against Mainz, which means they're in the top four. If they were to make the Champions League, that would be quite a story.
Archie, thank you so much for actually going to the kebab shop to do this report. I don't know if anyone else cares, but I really appreciate it.
I'll send pictures, Matt.
Oh,
no
wonderful.
Worries.
Cheers, mate. Archie Rintat out there at Lucas Podolski's kebab shop. In France, four of the top five won. The big game of the weekend was the Choc des Olympiques, the Clash of the Olympics. Marseille hosted Lyon. Marseille equalised through Kostas Mitroglou in the 84th minute before Memphis Depay scored a 90th minute winner for Lyon. The pitch descended into madness. Pamela Anderson's boyfriend, Adil Rami, seemed to lash out at a Lyon centre-back, Marcello, who then celebrated at the final whistle by taking his shirt off and holding it up in front of the home fans. Marseille's players reacted by starting a bit of a brawl. Yes?
I just saw this thing on the internet at the weekend, sort of translating reports from the Brazilian press, that Neymar is unhappy in Ligue 1.
Is that right?
Yeah, he might be having to look for a transfer in the summer, apparently, because he's gone there and he's found that it's not a very competitive division. And when he plays, there are quite often opposition players like single him out for aggressive tackling, which means that he's not able to fully express himself. And you know, the thing about Neymar is he really wants to win the Ballon d'Or.
Hmm.
And he might have to leave Paris Saint-Germain in order to achieve that dream.
Yeah, I also saw that he wants a pay rise from his basic of 650,000 after tax.
Seems fair enough.
Yeah.
So it could be that the Neymar PSG dream is over for all of us who are just enjoying it every step of the way. That's get it in while you can.
Do you hate anyone more than you hate Neymar?
No, not really. He is everything that's wrong with modern football, isn't he?
And in Ligue 2, two Auxerre players were in hot water after being sent off for fighting with each other, which is something we're a big fan of on the football pitch. Pierre-Yves Poloma and Michael Barreto started swinging at each other during Auxerre's 4-1 defeat at Crevy-Rouen on Friday. They were 3-1 down at the time. The game just carries on while they start fighting and an opposition player tries to split them up. I was at a game at Griffin Park where Brentford beat us 6-0 and we had Paul Rayner sent off for headbutting our own centre-back, Mick Heathcote, which is a disappointment.
For all.
What's for all? You'll never beat Mick Heathcote, was what we sang. But Paul Rayner managed to beat him by chinning him. Elsewhere in Europe, good video doing the rounds of a Galatasaray supporting family's reaction to an injury time miss in the Fenerbahce derby, which finished goalless. A shirtless man going wild at the TV, while I can only presume dad or granddad picks up a wooden chair and starts just hitting it repeatedly on the ground until grandma comes in and just tells them all to calm down a little bit. Producer Jonathan makes a good point that the TV does survive, whereas in previous videos, that's normally the object of the rage. Any other business on Jonathan Wilson's socks? I don't know if you heard this. He has a sort of a squad set up, as you can imagine, for all his socks. Paul says, I have an A team and a B team for my socks and a weekend team. Same for suit, shirts and ties. Always a sad moment when an A team sock loses its first team place. But such is life.
You know that me and Ellis James, you know, don't see eye to eye.
Oh, obviously, you hated his comedy gig once.
And he hates me as a result.
Yeah.
But he posted an image on social media of a pair of boxer shorts that his partner had decided was fit for the bin.
Mm.
And never had I felt such a direct moment of connection with James as in that moment.
Well, your pants go from normal wear to sports pants. and then the bin. That's my. That's, okay. Yeah, you know, when they're just a husk.
Can I just want to know from that reader, listener, can a pair of socks that have been put down, demoted, retrieve their place?
What if they hit form?
Yeah,
that's a very good.
I think otherwise it's a very harsh.
Absolutely right. My hunch, and obviously I can't speak for them, is that once you have been relegated to rot in the reserves, I think there is no coming back from that.
Does we'll he have a seating?
Out. Say again?
Does he have a seating? Or?
I don't know. I don't have as much detail.
Does he have a youth team which is just filled with pop socks?
Well, I hope that they grow. Here's some feedback on getting stuck in traffic in Ipswich. James says, hey Max, getting stuck behind a tractor on the A12 would be fine as it's a dual carriageway. The A140 to Norwich is a different story. Stop getting East Anglian roads wrong, clown. And we discussed Neil Warnock earlier on the pod, and last week we were talking about how competitive he was, and Nick Harris at Sporting Intel sent me this message. It's quite long, but it's good. Postscript to you on Thursday's Guardian pod on Wilson's story about Neil Warnock. Warnock was an indie columnist for quite a few years and attended several Christmas lunches, at which there was always a quiz. I write as a former long-time indie staffer from 98 to 2010, who carried on going to the Christmas lunches even after I left. To illustrate Warnock's competitiveness, perhaps even to a greater extent than Jonathan Wilson's, there was one year that Neil was on the winning quiz team. Each year, the sports desk manager, Nicole, would buy prizes to hand out to the winning team, typically plastic medals or ribbons from Woolworths or Poundland, but a medal nonetheless. And the year Warnock was on the winning team, for some reason, she obtained a trophy. In this instance, it was, if memory serves me correctly, a Sabutio FA Cup trophy. What I remember for sure, it was a tiny little plastic cup, very much in the Sabutio FA Cup mould, that a grown man could only pick up with two hands using a thumb and finger in each hand. Cutting to the chase, Warnock's team won the quiz that year, beating my team in another playoff. And no, I can't remember the tiebreaker. And after Nicole had put the medals around the neck, she handed the trophy to Warnock. Not only did he stand up and hold it aloft, as if in the Royal Box at Wembley, and bellow with glee. Remember, we were in some pub down a side street near High Street, Kensington, at 5 p.m. by this stage. He then walked around the pub, parading his trophy, shaking it in everyone's face with a winning intensity that had to be seen to be believed, which perhaps illustrates the drive that keeps him in football management approaching his 70th birthday, but also makes him look, at times, a little unhinged. Feel free to use Nick. Thank you very much. And that'll do for today. Paul McInnes, thanks for your time.
No, thank you.
Thank you, Jake.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.